This was the last day of August, 31st of August, 1976. We started in asking some embarrassing questions the last time. Might be you to receive those questions before we go on. And nobody answered the first question at all. The question was, what is life? What is life? I don't believe in answer that way, because you can't really say that. Death is not a positive product. And I don't know whether you can really speak about the absence of death. A little bit like the absence of darkness. Well, absence of darkness would never make light. And the absence of death would never make life. Life, in general. No. Nobody, we haven't any scientists yet, I can tell you. And then, where does life come from? I don't think that's too hard, then. God is a life giver of any kind of life that there is, regardless of what it may be. From the smallest little microbe that you can mention to the biggest creatures we have, and trees and so on. Yes. But they'll probably blow up in their faces. You know, there was a man made a Frankenstein one time, too. Man usually does. Movies? Frankenstein was written long before they had any movies. I didn't know they even had it in the movie. Well, what has life? That's narrowing down a little bit. How about grass? Well, animate. Yes and no. You see, animate comes from animus. An animus is a mind. Of course, now they do say it's your garden stuff will respond to talking and to music and so on. That might be something there. According to Huxley, what is the basic bricks, or whatever you want to call them, that life is made of? Living things, I better put it that way, living things. He didn't invent that. Huxley lived many years ago. All life is made, ideas, every living thing is made up of cells. Now, some of them are so small that they have only one cell, the little amoeba. And so the cells, and these cells, of course, when they're living, have in them a material called protoplasm. And that is, so far as we know right now, seems to be the basis of life, protoplasm. Now, if you want to get an opposite of life, that's not too hard to answer. That's like opposite of life. That's death. Are there any objects about us that never have life? We speak of inanimate objects. That is, objects that do not have life. That's the stones and bricks and so on about us. Anything made of iron, steel, brass, and whatnot. And, of course, that included idols, which were inanimate. Poor old Dagon fell right over on his face when the Ark of the Testimony was put in his house. Now, they busted his nose or not. Unable to help himself, an idol, and the people worshipped them and thought that they would bless them and give them lots of things and so on, and they had to prop them up. They couldn't even stand. So that's something that never has life and it never can give life. And then we talk about a difference between life and immortality. And the question was, could Adam have had immortality by eating of the tree of life? And did anybody answer that? Well, I have a question here that we touched on last week, and this has caused lots of controversy. My ass and a lot of stuff in print on this question. Was Adam created immortal? My, oh my. You know what orthodoxy thinks about that, of course, in general. That he was created immortal, and then he lost his immortality. Well, if he lost it and died, then he never had immortality, did he? So that's absurd. Make a statement like that. Because if he was created immortal, he'd be around here yet. And would always be. I don't know. Some of these Calvinists who believe and say, once saved, always saved, and so on, what they would answer to that. I don't know. How to get around that. I never heard one of them try it. Quite a question. What is one of the proofs that Adam was not immortal? That he was mortal. What was one of the proofs of it? There were two of them, at least. The tree of life was put there so he might prolong his life. Otherwise, why, he would die. And, of course, the other proof is that he did die. He wasn't immortal, so... Well, then I went a little further in my questions. Was Adam dying before he sinned? As you and I. Yeah, made of dust of the earth, sure. It would be decay and so on, as our bodies do, sure. He's made just like you and I. Yeah, give him a shot in the arm. He lived 930 years without us, under the conditions he had at that time. And being a good healthy specimen, his ancestors hadn't imbibed in a lot of things they shouldn't. So he had a pretty good chance to start with. He didn't have heredity like a lot of us have. You know, a lot of us go back looking on our family tree and you might find a horse teeth hanging from one limb somewhere. Adam didn't have that problem. Well, we ended up sort of last week with Ecclesiastes 3:19-23, where it says, in the matter of life, there's no difference between a man and an animal. They both died alike, and they both went to the same place. So, as far as man and animal is concerned, that material they're made of is the same material. They come to the same end, death. The animal does not, or was not made in the likeness of the image of God. There's one difference. Man was given a right of choice. Animals have some choice, but not based usually upon reasoning. They have some reasoning sometimes. You watch them, you get pretty well acquainted with some of these animals, and you find they can figure things out sometimes. Some of these horses can learn how to unlatch the door and do it quickly. A lot of little tricks they can learn. Find them out for themselves. I know a test that they made years ago about the monkey. It was put a monkey in a cage and hung a banana up and put a stool in there in the cage and a stick was put fastened together with a socket. And the monkey looked all around and he couldn't reach the banana and finally got the stool and stood upon that and couldn't reach the banana and he got that stick and pretty soon he began working with it and so on. He got it together and reached up and knocked down the banana. Now, they have that much knowledge. But sometimes smarter than men, maybe. But it isn't the kind of knowledge that man had. When Adam was created, he had knowledge that he could classify the animals and the plants and name them. And of course, through tradition and so on, it's common opinion at least that Adam knew a great deal about astronomy and a lot of other subjects. That he had a built-in knowledge. Well, he sort of traded that off, you know, for reasoning. And reasoning isn't as good as built-in knowledge. Of course, all the time you must remember this, that man was not created with instincts like the animals were. And there is one great difference. Man has to learn many things from experience and so on. Animals have instincts. They don't need to learn those things. Or they learn a lot of things along in life. That's true. We have a bunch of cattle out here. Quite a number of them. About 56 head out there. They all know what an electric fence is, I guess. And they don't bother. Now, they've learned that much. But the little single-cell amoeba will propel itself toward light. It has that much sensitivity. And they have a slight amount of motion. And so there's even a response with the little one-celled animal. This is, of course, along the line of science and so on, but I think sometimes we ought to stop and think, maybe, what is man? And maybe we need to answer the question sometimes of why do we act as we do? Well, in the Old Testament, there is a word that is translated soul 477 times. With a possible minus two, possibly 475, because a couple of places are a little bit questionable. And that word is nephesh, N-E-P-H-E-S-H. Now I said it's 477 times, or 475 maybe, but the word itself, nephesh, occurs 753 times. So it isn't always translated soul by any means. Take a look at Isaiah 57:16. For I will not contend forever, neither will I always be wroth. For the spirit shall fail before me, and the soul which I have made. And the word soul there is not nephesh. It's nasama, as you see in the margin, breathing things. So the word soul is used there, but it's not nephesh. There's only one other place where it, some other word is translated soul. And that is in Job 30:15. Job 30:15. Job 30:15. Page 702. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my soul as the wind, and my welfare passeth away as a cloud. The word there is not nephesh. However, in the next sentence, and now my soul is poured out, and that is nephesh. So, give you a little idea of the translation. Now, translated at least 475 times as soul, we find it translated 120 times as life. So there must be a great deal of relationship between life and soul. Now, I wonder just how much difference there is. You see, we have something very similar in the Greek, which we'll get into, life and soul. You see, it's translated in Genesis 1, its first occurrence. Let's look at that. See how it's used, the first time it's used in the Bible, the word nephesh. In here so that I could hit them right off. I don't have to mark my other Bible. Well, I can just see here one of them quickly in 120. The half life, moving creature, the half life. And look in your margin, life is soul, nephesh. And he tells you, you find it in the next verse, and there it is translated creature. Every creature or soul that moveth. And, let's see here.
24.
Yeah, 24 comes next. There's the word creature. Nephesh. Yeah. And 30. Everything that creepeth wherein there is life. Again, nephesh. So you see, you have soul and life both used there, and they're used as things that were created and on the earth before Adam, at least the last one before Adam was created. And so then when you get down to 2:7, you find it used there in connection with Adam. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground. And he breathed in his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Living soul. A breathing soul. A breather. 39 times it is translated as man, person, fellow, any, and one. Five different words there under one category. It's used as a personal pronoun 36 times. Like my soul has desired something, which means I myself. It can be translated will, mind, desire, pleasure, appetite, and lust. And does occur 49 times. With those six. We already saw that it is translated creature, also beast, and just the word thing, and in one instance it's translated tablet. That looks like a long way off, doesn't it? 15 times in 04. It's also spoken of as the dead, and also the dead body, and also mortally. So it has to do with death then in three different words. Another three is deadly and greedy and hearty. And then another three, filling up the whole list, is ghost, breath of life. Oh yes, I think ghost is used twice. And breath of life. So it makes another three. Which means that in the translation of this word nephesh in the Old Testament, our translators have used 44 English words to translate it. 44 English words to translate that little word nephesh. And you cannot use one word for all of them. Just like lots and lots of other words, you go to translate from one language to another, You cannot translate word for word. You're soon getting a dead end. Now, it is true that the little word psuche, T-S-U-C-H-E, the Greek word, can always be used for this word mythos. So there's that much relationship between the Hebrew and the Greek, that the Greek can translate it over every time of that one word. But I don't know of any other languages which that could be done. They get into the French, they get into the German, Latin, and so on, and they're going to have a variety of words. Probably less with Latin than any of the others, because it's more of a primitive language and closer related to the Greek. And when we get into our English language, of course, we have a great variety. Which means, then, that word does express quite a variety of ideas. And then we have to pick out that idea from its context and use a suitable English word in the translator. That's what our problem is. And we wouldn't say that Adam breathed through his nostrils the breath of life and became a dead body. You can't do that. The context doesn't allow that, you see. Or Adam became a beast. We wouldn't exactly say that either, because the Bible does differentiate between the beast and man. And he certainly didn't become tablets. Now, tablets is something probably to write on or something like that. They're not something you get out of the medicine chest. Now, we have a term in the Bible used a great deal in the New Testament, and especially a favorite of John the Apostle, and that is everlasting life. Now, does this everlasting life come to us by birth, or do we have to get it as a gift from God? We have to receive it as a gift. Well, now, if we were to make an analogy with man and with, the plants on the earth, the seeds and so on, we'd find a little bit of the opposite, wouldn't we? Because they naturally come with life in them. Man doesn't. He's under death. Well, there happens to be a little difference there between man and these little seeds. Now, it isn't true of animals, you see. They are like man in that respect. But everlasting life, that is, a life at the age of abiding, a life that does not die during the ages, the only one we know of that doesn't die during the ages, that life, this everlasting life, is a gift from God. And it's a partaking of the divine nature of God, as Peter says. It is something that John says we can have right here and now. In fact, it's synonymous, practically, with this new nature, new man, and other names that we have for it. Well, we do have some great truths revealed to us. There are some things that are not revealed. We find in the Bible that there are many great truths that are revealed to us, not for us to reason and work out and come to a conclusion, but quite often there are great truths that are revealed to us that we have to accept by faith. Now, there may come a time when some of the things we accept by faith may come into the realm of our reasoning, and we can see the meaning of it. But essentially, what the Bible tells us, what God says, is something that is to be received by faith. We may get some sight later on. Faith is believing what God has said and acting on it. Now, there is something that is in opposition to all life. I can say that, I think, without much hedging. Something is in opposition to all life. A principle has come into the world And it has brought death and desolation and everything else. The oversoul. What is that little three-letter word that has brought about all of this desolation? Sin. And what is the result of sin? Sin and death. Now, sin came into the universe long before Adam was here. And by the one man, sin came into the present cosmos or world. That is Adam. Now, going back to the origin of sin, and we've seen a little bit of that in our studies in the plan and purpose and the marks of the ages. Now, we have sort of discovered that there must be some other aspect of sin than merely death as we know it. And that makes us wonder what is involved in that promise that was made before the ages began, that there should be eternal life. A promise of eternal life in Christ before the ages began, before sin and death came even into the universe the first time. And it makes us wonder, well, what sin was there, and what was the death that it resulted in? Of course, it's not hard to tell what the sin was, because we're told that it originated in Satan, and because of his pride and his wanting to better his position, he thought, which he probably couldn't have done anyhow. They saw some greener grass over on the other side of the field. And that's what caused the trouble. Now, in that downfall of his, evidently, he had brought in death of some kind, because that's the natural result of sin. So, death, as we think of it today, and we really don't know what, because death occurs when the protoplasm no longer protoplasm, no longer living. Then comes death. Now, what's the difference between protoplasm before and after death? Well, that's a pretty hard one to tell. I can remember a preacher years ago came in here, and he'd been working with a microscope and studying the science and so on. He was trying to find out just what made this protoplasm tick, and what happened when it died, and what it was when it died, and so on. He was all full of questions. Of course, he never got an answer. But that's a good place to start, anyhow. It's a good idea for one to make questions like that, because you might discover some things. Well, would it be proper to say that possibly that first sin, which was rebellion against God, brought about something that would dim the glory of God, his reputation among his created beings, and so on? Could we rate that possibly as bringing death into the universe? And if so, if that is the thing that has to be eradicated sometime so that there can be life again, God all in all, possibly we can rate that as at that point, at least, that this death did question God's justness, question his glory, and so on. And of course, you can see that Satan was thinking of that very thing when he spoke to Eve, because the very first thing was, well, has God said? Could God say such a thing? You see, bringing a doubt into our mind as to whether God spoke truth or not, whether she should believe God or not. And of course, we know that all those things bring death. So then there is a sin and a death that possibly is a little different from what we know in our own discoveries and our own practice and so on. However, there is in nature. Nothing can be found in nature that can be an antidote for this death that follows sin. I say nature has never found an antidote. Not an anecdote, but antidote. Nature has no way of ever recovering from the ruins of sin and death. In fact, there is no process in nature yet, not even in a test tube. There's no such process as a resurrection from death in nature. Absolutely lacking. Now you see, we started out with the proposition that life emanated from God. Death comes as a result of sin. Now we also came to the conclusion that everlasting life was a gift from God. And we also know from chapter 6 in John's Gospel that those who have everlasting life will be raised at the last day. That's for those folks the Lord was talking to at that time. And of course we find similar things expressed in different way in the prison epistles. Which means then that death is absolutely irrevocable. It cannot be reversed except by a divine intervention. Something has to be done. And also, when we go on and study what God does do, how He does intervene, we discover that He is called a new creation. That's the only answer to death. Resurrection, as far as human beings are concerned. Resurrection. And of course, that just means to stand up again. That's really what the word means, to stand up again. So man has never discovered yet an antidote for sin and its results, and he's never been able to find in his laboratories and his test tubes and so on any process in nature such as a resurrection from death. And we are told that life and immortality are brought to life in the gospel. And so then we have this record in 1 John 5:11-12. This is the record that God hath given to us eternal life. And that life is in his Son. He that hath the Son hath the life. And he that hath not the Son hath not the life. Well, now getting into the New Testament, we find the word life occurs 46 times. And 40 of those times, it is psuche, P-S-U-C-H-E. Now, we get the word psychology from psuche. Just change the letters a little bit. I change the U to a Y, P-S-Y instead of P-S-U. Psychology. A study of the psuche. The soul, the life, man. Well, now the word psuche is also translated soul as well as life. It's translated 40 times as life, 58 times as soul. And then a few other ones, such as heart, heartily, and the word mind, 6 times. And translated you, the personal pronoun, once. Now, there's another word in the New Testament that is translated life besides psuche. And it's zoe, Z-O-E, or I want to make it in Greek probably zoe, but we just call it zoe. We get zoology from it. That's the study of life. But zoology is not a study of the soul. And this word soul is never translated soul. So now we're going to get a difference between the two words. For instance, we read, in him was Zoe, and the Zoe was the light of men. In the first chapter of John, remember? And this is the record, and we just read this one, that God has given to us Zoe eternal. And this Zoe is in his Son. He that hath the Son hath Zoe, and he that hath not the Son hath not Zoe. Another one, we know that we have passed from death unto Zoe, because we love the brethren. Another one, hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his suke for us, and we ought to lay down our suke for the brethren. Again, you see, this was translated life in English, but it's the word suke in this case. He laid down his suke for us, and we ought to lay down our suke for our brethren, not the Zoe. Now, suke is never said to be everlasting. This psychology, the psyche, whatever it is, is never said to be everlasting. It's never used as the word everlasting. Only Zoe is ever used in that particular sense. Now, one can have suke and still be dead. Let the dead bury their dead. And it is also true that you can have both suke and Zoe at the same time. Now, this suke is same as nephesh in the Old Testament. Now, God gave that one. He gave it to Adam. And all who have lived after Adam have had it transmitted to them from him. That might kind of get me in trouble with some of the authorities, wouldn't it? Because there's a great deal of debate nowadays of where does life begin. Trying to find excuses for murdering unborn infants. But that is transmitted from Adam. And I don't think there's any question about when it begins. And so all men are born with that nephesh or suke now. So that life is not given to us today, but inherited. So we do inherit one life. But in all cases, this Zoe, which is with the word eternal, quite often, must be a gift. It cannot be inherited, and it can't be gotten in any other way except as a gift. Now, do you have any question on that? That seems to that little study. Or have I gotten you all confused? Sometimes that happens too. Well, I think what happened there was just this. Man had an inbuilt, we can't say innate knowledge, because that uses the word birth, and he didn't have anything but birth. Adam had a built-in knowledge, we'll put it that way, and it just could be that knowledge could have committed, been carried on down to his offspring. Now, we don't know for sure on that, but he lost something there. He traded that all for reasoning, the knowledge of good and evil. And when you know those two things, then you begin to reason back and forth. When you only knew the good, there was no reasoning with it connected with it. You had it, that was it. Nothing to differ with it, and nothing to compare with it, and so on. You just had it. And so that takes us back to a question we've given before. When did God begin to know evil? Because he said you should be as God and know good from evil. When did God first know evil? He might have, because it repented him and he made man. Repented of some other things. You see, all knowledge can be classed under good and evil. Now, as far as an experimental knowledge of evil is concerned, I'll say the experimental knowledge now. God never experienced it until one of his great creatures fell. And that's when he really experienced evil. And, of course, mankind never experienced evil. They were warned not to eat of that fruit and so on, and they knew that that would be evil, yes. But they actually never experienced or anything like that until they ate of the fruit and discovered, first of all, they were naked. They began to discover something. And so then they had a working knowledge of it, of evil. And man has been comparing things that differ ever since. That's the way he has to get along in life and learn the hard way. No inbuilt knowledge, and as I said, no instinct. Man does not instinctively go out and build a house, as ancestors for many, many years before had done it, without being taught to do it. A baby was brought up out in the wilderness somewhere where there weren't any houses and never think of building a house. But a little bird, when it comes time, nesting time and so on, and actually build a nest like all their ancestors have built. Now there can be some slow variations in that. We notice that in nature, slow variations. I can give you an example. When I was a boy. I saw lots of these red-winged blackbirds, which we still have with us today and sometimes get to be a nuisance. But they built their nests always in the marshy places and especially among the cattails. And they have changed that habit to a great extent, and they do a lot of nesting out in the alfalfa field, which we didn't have then. I can remember when alfalfa was first brought into our community. And I was taking pictures at that time and took a picture out in the field, doodling it up and getting it ready to load and fall into the barn. My first camera. And other animals and birds and so on adapt themselves to some extent to their surroundings. A little bird was brought over to this country, which in its own country was a pretty good little bird. Ate bugs and so on, wasn't a nuisance at all, but he came over here and adapted himself in this country, and he's one of the biggest nuisances we got, and that's a little sparrow, an English sparrow. Oh, I'll admit that he will eat some cabbage worms. I don't know what else he's good for. He's just out of his place somewhere or other. And you can think of many things like that, where there's been some slow adaptation to surroundings. Our birds and even some of the animals, we don't have many migratory animals anymore because our civilization stopped all of that. They do have migratory birds,